Now being 4:30, I think we ought to make a start. People have a very busy programme ahead of us, but first of all, welcome to this seminar this afternoon. I think we have a very interesting and topical subject, which is not only perhaps one of the most important questions to ask in the Middle East region, but also has implications for the world at large as well. And so I'm delighted to say I think we have two sessions with excellent panellists. The way that we will run this is to have each of our three speakers on each of the panels speak to us for about 10 minutes. And then after that, we'll open it up. I think we've got about 25 minutes each time for questions and comments from the floor. So I'll explain how that can work when we get there. I'm not going to introduce the panelists at length because you all have their biographies, but I will mention them when we get to that. As I say, the subject itself is a very topical one. We've entitled it Iran, Saudi Arabia, Power Shifts and Sectarian Divides, the Challenging Geopolitics of the Middle East, which was about as neutral a title as we could think of for the purposes of this particular seminar. And we've broken it up into two parts. The first bit is the political, diplomatic and military perspectives of what is happening there. And the second part is the reporting the region, the broader perspectives. And so, without more ado, I will move to the first part, the first session. We have three speakers, and I will briefly introduce them now. On my right, Jack Straw, the Right Honourable Jack Straw, needs really no introduction. Former Foreign Secretary, Home Secretary, Chancellor, Lord Chancellor, and Secretary of State for Justice. So we can ask him all sorts of questions about all sorts of different aspects of his expertise. And then on my immediate left, Sir Derek Plumley, who is the Visiting Professor of Middle Eastern Studies at IMES. He was British Ambassador to Egypt from 2003 to 2007, and before that, Ambassador to Saudi Arabia between 2000 and 2003, which is where I first met him. And then on my far left, Lieutenant General Sir Graham Lamb, former Director of UK Special Forces and Commander of the British Field Army, and again, my first experience of him was in Basra just after Saddam Hussein was toppled, so he also has a great deal of knowledge and expertise about this particular region. Without more ado, I'm going to ask Jack Straw if he will talk to us for about 10 minutes, and then we'll have the other two speakers after that. Jack, thank you.
Thanks very much, Michael, and given what you just said earlier about any questions, and this is about Iran, Saudi Arabia and the Middle East, I will decline the opportunity which has been taken this morning by one of my successors as Justice Secretary to opine on the relationship between the latest deal on the European Union and the operation of the European Court of Justice. Let me start with some metrics. Saudi Arabia has a population of 32 million, which is just 40% of Iran's 79 million. But Saudi's GDP, $746 billion, is 80% more than Iran's at $416 billion. That makes Saudi's GDP per head at $20,000 more than four times that of Iran's. Saudi Arabia and Iran may share a common waterway, the Persian Gulf, a common geology, which makes both hydrocarbon rich. They worship the same god and revere the same holy prophet. But culturally, historically, linguistically, and in terms of faith, the distinction between these two societies is much more striking to me than the commonalities. Iran is the border of the West, one Iranian proudly told me late last year as we looked at Henry Moore's sculptures, which happened, by the way, to celebrate copulation, which are openly displayed in the public gardens of the Museum of Modern Art in Tehran, established by the Shah's wife, and unscathed throughout the 1979 revolution until today. This observation is far from being wholly incorrect. Whilst they regard Alexander as the terrorist rather than the great, Persian culture and thought is heavily influenced by Greek philosophy, and the historical influences on them until they were invaded by the Arabs were east, west and north. The most significant national festival in their calendar is not Muslim, but Zoroastrian, Nowruz, the Persian New Year. The language may share an alphabet with the Arab world, but its syntax and grammar is Indo-European. and their national conversion to Shiism by the Safavid dynasty in the 16th century has exerted an even more powerful sense of exceptionalism upon the Iranian nation than the rise of Protestantism did in Northern Europe, coincidentally, in the same century. And I was last in Iran for 2 weeks in the autumn, during the long period of Moharram, the annual period of mourning, with the Shura on its 10th day, a period of mourning for the martyrdom of Hussein by Sunnis, a constant reminder to the Iranians of the cause, as they see it, of the schism at the heart of Islam. Rivalry between these two cultures, and from the 20th century between these two countries, is deep-seated. It's complicated on both sides. At a conference I attended last December in Abu Dhabi, one of the pro-Saudi speakers observed, quotes, that the paradox of Iran and Saudi Arabia is that the Saudis have a superiority complex over the Shia, but an inferiority complex in respect of the Persians. And this rivalry easily predates the Iranian Revolution of 79, but it's become much more intense since then. And the principal cause of this was and remains the 1980-88 Iran-Iraq War. Though this has dropped out of consciousness of many in the West, if it was ever there, this war is absolutely fundamental to any understanding of the tensions across the Gulf today. The war was an unprovoked act of aggression by Saddam Hussein. Its pretext was an argument over the Shatt al-Arab waterway, but its aim was to take territory from Iran and, if possible, to see an end to the Islamic regime which had just taken over in Tehran. And in this, Saddam was backed by almost the whole of the Arab world, especially Saudi and other Gulf nations who bankrolled Saddam throughout this period. Moreover, they were joined in this endeavour by a wide alliance of other arms suppliers, notably the Soviet Union and France, who were the two huge suppliers, but most Western countries. And irony of irony, the only reliable supplier of arms between 1980 and 86 to Iran was Israel, which could be the subject of another who provided 2 billion of arms during that period. There are many historians who argue that the war should have ended earlier and that but for the intransigence by the Iranian regime, it could have done. Be that as it may, it dragged on for 8 long years, causing hundreds of thousands of deaths on both sides. For the Iranians especially, it was existential. In the first crucial years of the war, apart from a bit of armed supplies from Israel, Iran was wholly isolated. This strengthened their already powerful sense of exceptionalism, and moreover, quite contrary to Saddam's purposes and that of other Arab leaders, the external conflict enabled Ayatollah Khomeini and his regime to reinforce their position in the country and to establish their Islamic Republic in a way which almost certainly would not have happened but for the war. And there's a further crucial point about this war. Although it finished almost 3 decades ago, it has completely defined Iranian politics since, and many of those who played a leading role during the war still hold very considerable positions of power today, including Ayatollah Khamenei, Rafsanjani, and President Rouhani, and many, many others. One reason why this war dragged on for so long was because the Iraqis would not agree to one of the key Iranian demands, that Saddam Hussein should relinquish power. It's one of history's great ironies that it took the work of the great Satan, the United States, and the wily Satan, we Brits, to deliver to the Iranians this prize which in 8 years of war had wholly eluded them. But deliver we did, and the moment that Iraq moved from dictatorship to a semblance of democracy, the Shia majority in Iraq were bound to become the most powerful group in that country. And I say I've been reading a lot of material by way of background for this, on both sides of this argument, which is what it is between the Saudis and the Iranians. It certainly doesn't lie in anybody's mouth in the West, not including mine, to complain about the fact that the Iranians now have influence in Iraq. It was an inevitable and predictable consequence of the removal of a dictatorship and the replacement by, as I say, a semblance of democracy there. That said, if you talk to Iraqi Shia, they are Iraqis, they're Arabs, and they feel very strongly about their nation, and they have no wish or desire to be ventriloquized by Iran. If you look at any commentary by senior Saudi figures about Iran and by senior Iranian figures about Saudi Arabia, you are struck by how much each is preoccupied with making rebarbative comments about the other, how little there is in the way of constructive proposals for putting their relationship on a more constructive plane. And indeed, the gulf between them, the diplomatic gulf, has deteriorated, gone down, even deepened much more following the execution of Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr and the subsequent storming of the Saudi embassy. And I may say that one of the many things that Iran has got to do, if it's going to be taken really seriously in the rest of the world, is ensure that diplomatic missions are protected, as they are everywhere else in the world. But there also, there's a nuclear deal, and on the other side, serious worries about the future of governance of Saudi Arabia, given King Salman's indisposition and the obvious jockeying for power that's taking place in that country. And then on the other side, there are the elections for the Majlis and the Assembly of Experts in Iran this Friday. I don't know any more than anybody else about what's going to happen, but no one should hold their breath for this being a clean sweep of Rouhani candidates, not the least of which reason is that many Rouhani candidates were excluded altogether by the Guardian Council from standing. Say, for example, in Qom, there are no reformist candidates. On a relative scale, the moderate candidate is the Speaker of the Majlis, Larijani, who's had various positions, shall we say, in the past. And meanwhile, much of the Arab neighbourhood for both countries is in flames, literally as well as figuratively. But the underlying cause of these, one of the things why I'm frustrated about the rebarbative rhetoric on both sides, is neither Saudi Arabia nor Iran. Neither Saudi Arabia nor Iran caused, for example, the civil war in Syria. Those causes are to be found within Syria. And the causes are deep-seated defects in those societies, exacerbated in many cases by poverty, inequality, corruption, and a failure to develop serious political and judicial institutions. Though Saudi is well off, Iran is middle income, and the rest of the Gulf very wealthy, there is serious poverty on their doorsteps. We all know about Syria. Less well known is Yemen. But Yemen has a population not much less than Saudi Arabia's, 25 million to 32 million, but its GDP per head is a fraction, 1/16th of Saudi Arabia's. It's 40% Shia, but most of those are Zaidi fivers, not 12ers Jafari, like the Iranians. And in any event, it's riven by tribal and class complexities. So if we are, we know what the problem is, if we are to see any possibility of improved relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, what needs to be done? The first is, I say with respect to my Saudi friends, is that they need to accept both the fact of the nuclear deal, if you like, as a fait accompli. It is a fact, and in my judgment, regardless of what happens in the US elections, it will stick, certainly so far as European nations, Russia and China are concerned. So it is a fact. But also, I hope come round to the view, which I very strongly hold as someone who began those negotiations with my French and German counterparts now almost 13 years ago, that it is the best guarantee we have of ensuring that Iran does not develop a nuclear weapon. Secondly, diplomatic relations need to be re-established. It's easier to break off diplomatic relations, more difficult to get them back. But you need good diplomatic relations, effective diplomatic relations with countries with whom you disagree, far more than you need them with countries with whom you agree. Third, there need to be talks on the revival of the Iran-Saudi Security Pact, which was signed in 1998 when Rouhani was the National Security Director of Iran, but has fallen into disrepair and disuse. And my fourth point before I sit down is that There has to be a development of other institutions for securing greater cooperation across the Gulf, maybe by using Oman, which has good relations both with other Gulf countries and with Iran, as an honest broker. All of these things are easier said than done, but if they're not done, the Middle East and the Arab world, the wider Middle East and the Arab world, will, I think, continue to deteriorate as a place of great instability and violence. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jack, for what I think was an excellent introduction to this session. I'm now going to call on Sir Derek Pumphrey.
I'd like, first of all, to thank the Global Strategy Forum for organising this seminar, because I think it's a very timely subject to discuss. And it's a privilege to be here on this panel and to join the discussion with you. Inevitably, given my background, I will say a bit more about the Arab dimension and the diplomatic one, with all due deference to those in the audience who are actually practicing Arab diplomats or whatever, therefore know the scene more up to date, in a more up to date way than I. The last time I saw Jack Straw or Lord Lothian was indeed in Riyadh, I think, at different points between 2000 and 2003. And there have been extraordinary shifts in the geopolitics of the region since that time. Many of which obviously stem from the events that were taking place then. The rise, inevitably, I think, as Jack Straw said, in post-invasion Iraq of Iranian influence, the emergence of what was eventually going to become ISIS, and the reaction in the United States to the whole Iraq experience that they've been through. And the latter, of course, has been reflected in the stance of the present American administration with relation to the Middle East and their reluctance to intervene, even in August 2013 when the president's red line on chemical warfare was crossed by the Syrian regime, even then to intervene. And as a result, of course, Russia has been able to exploit that absence, in particular in Syria, but perhaps more generally in the region is able to do so. So I think that is one really big geopolitical strand to the discussion, which actually influences how people in the region, in the Arab world in particular, see current developments. The Iran nuclear deal, of course, is an exception to this critique. It's a great achievement, and I agree absolutely with Jack Straw, and it holds out the possibility of further positive developments as Iran opens up. But that's not a foregone conclusion. As was said, we can't foretell the continuing balance of power within Iran and how it would develop, what indeed will happen in this coming week's elections. And it seems to me that it is important to maintain our guard and to be understanding, at least, of the concerns of our Arab partners about it. There is, as has been related, deep mistrust in the Arab world, specifically in Saudi Arabia and in parts of the Gulf of Iran, and that goes back to the period before the Islamic Revolution, but of course the suffering horrors of the Iran-Iraq War, which were mentioned, colour it. It's not primarily confessional. I know we'll be getting on to the sectarian issue later, although at times the confessional issue gives it greater edge, sharper edge. And that is true, I think, at this present moment because of the course that the Syrian war has taken and before that because of the events in Bahrain and so on. But it's more to do with fear, skepticism, with regard to Iran's long-term intentions. Whatever the history of that, the fear now, I suppose, in relation to a nuclear deal will be the impact of the accretion of funds and the use to which they may be put. And actually, if you're sitting there, the image is as much Qasem Soleimani as it is the foreign minister. The way in which the regime in Syria has been propped up through these years, first of all, increasingly by Hezbollah, by Iranian militias, and so on. And it's simplistic, I think, to look at shifts in Middle East politics, geopolitics, purely in terms of relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, or their relations with the West. Immense change because of the Arab Spring, the heat's off Israel, externally at least, Turkey's engaged. And Arab countries, which formerly shared the lead on regional issues, are either a battleground, like Syria, or finding their way back painfully from the brink, as in the case of Egypt, with massive help from Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Kuwait. For the Gulf countries, I believe the key driver, but it's for them to say and represent it in the audience, is the same as always, the search for security and stability, their own and that of their immediate neighborhood. But they find, for the reasons I've given, the absence of these other voices in the Arab world, or the silencing of them to a significant degree, and the stance taken by the West, they find themselves untypically exposed, and in Saudi Arabia's case, by virtue of its size and standing, in an enforced position of leadership in the wider region. In Lebanon, interlocutors, I was the UN Secretary General's representative in Lebanon until last year, and their interlocutors would always tell you that if Saudi Arabia and Iran could work things out, the problem, whatever it might be, would be solved. And in September 2014, I visited both, and both were hinting at the possibility of bilateral discussion on the different regional issues. And I fully agree with Jack that it is desirable that discussion continue and people get back on course. But at that point, and if such an opportunity did exist then, it was definitively killed by what happened in Yemen, in terms of the advance of the Houthis on Sana'a, the flight of President Hadi, and of course the intervention led by Saudi Arabia and other GCC countries, UAE, which is new, obviously, and it's not the first time that Saudi Arabia or Gulf countries have engaged militarily, but it's the first time they've done so on such a scale, with such ambition and such readiness to use armed force to achieve the desired outcome. If there is to be a peaceful solution, it must lie between talks between the parties, which the UN has been encouraging and which have taken place, with and Saudis have been encouraging, and their resumption is clearly in everybody's interest. This is not one of those issues. Fear, I think, of the links between the Houthis and Iran was clearly one motivating factor, has been in what's taken place. But this is a negotiation which is really for the parties. In the Levant, on the other hand, clearly it's essential that the Saudis and the Iranians should be in the same negotiating room, notwithstanding what has been referred to, which is the present rupture in their relations. And I would argue, actually, that the recent grim evolution of the Syrian crisis with the Russian intervention, the increasing pressure on Aleppo, would only underline the importance, actually, of sustaining and strengthening the hand of the opposition at this point in time, and sustaining the focus on a real transition, which, after all, and this is, must be our objective in all of this, enables us to address the refugee crisis satisfactorily and to turn attention to and begin to roll back ISIS, Daesh, within Syria. So there's a voice, a role, which is very important, which Saudi Arabia in particular is playing within those negotiations. And that is something to be welcomed. We'll just mention briefly my experience in Lebanon, because this is a place where, for the past 4 years, Saudi Arabia and Iran and their allies on the ground have effectively managed at a distance or through their allies on the ground what is a fragile stability, a stability which is reflected in a government of national unity, which is inclusive and so on. And I think that's really important to sustain. It's an example of how a modus vivendi can be established because of the rupture in the relations which followed the attack on the Saudi and embassy and consulate in Iran, which I mentioned. There has been, there is a new crisis, I think a crisis in relations between the Lebanese and some Gulf governments and indeed Saudi Arabia because of the position taken by the Lebanese foreign minister specifically in discussions on the Arab response. But I very much hope that will be worked through because the stability and security of the neighbouring states and Lebanon is very much in the front line is important, and that's something which I think should be of concern to all of the powers involved outside, and in this case Iran and Saudi Arabia. Last word, just to emphasize, having served there and spent my time there and being close to relations between the United Kingdom and the Gulf in particular over a long period, to say that one does feel that whatever happens, and we are talking, as Jack said, about new, younger leaderships coming along in key Gulf countries and responding, as I've described in relation to some of these crises, with a decision and providing a leadership of a sort which is new, basically. They have been doing well at home in responding to challenges, the counter-terrorism challenge springing from ISIS and so on. We need to be there with them. The United Kingdom needs to be there with them, supporting them through this. It's a difficult time. Clearly, we must hope and work for, ultimately, a restoration of understanding and cooperation across the Gulf. It is an opportunity for everybody, but with caution and recognizing the importance economically, commercially, security terms, counter-terrorism terms, of that key relationship in the Gulf.
Yes, a simple soldier's view. This is the best I can offer. The answer is this is a really dangerous audience. You actually know what you're talking about, but I'll give you a personal view as how I see this subject, and probably just find it down to one space. For all my time spent in the Middle East, I am at best just a journeyman. The recent political dialogue and achievement in securing the joint comprehensive plan of action between Iran and the P5+1 was a significant achievement, and one which, as a soldier, I truly applaud, as it is better in Hobbes's world to jaw than to war. But as Lawrence alluded to in Article 23 of his 27 articles, let me remind you the bit that matters. He said, but always there will be a better reason left for you to discover. You must find these inner reasons. They will be denied, but are nonetheless in operation. That nothing in this region, to which I most definitely include Iran, is quite what it seems, and I believe the deal is no different. I have no doubt that the Iranian Foreign Minister, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Mohammad Javad Zarif, and the P5+1, our own Foreign Minister, Philip Hammond, and the Secretary, John Kerry, all acted well, respectfully, and in good faith, and intended to do their utmost to keep to their promises in what was agreed in that deal. But I would suggest that the Iranian Foreign Ministry, as Lord Tennyson captured in his poem Ulysses, is but a part of all that it has met. And Iran's actions in the regions might suggest that others with as much, if not more, influence beyond the immediate borders of Iran, decided not to be part of this debate, but merely to benefit from it. Let me explain. In 2008, General Petraeus, who I was working with, who I'd worked for, was sought out by a very senior Iraqi official with a message from General Soleimani, leader of the Iranian Republican Guard Quds Force, in which he conveyed the following. General Petraeus, you should be aware that I, General Soleimani, control Iran's policy for Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Gaza, and Afghanistan. General Soleimani's point was abundantly clear. He saw it that he owned the policy and the fight in the region, and General Petraeus should deal with him. Notwithstanding a touch of theatre, an obvious ego, and a wish to impress, there is simply, in my opinion, more than a grain of truth in his claim. And the general hasn't gone away, and the fight continues. As a soldier, I have learned through hard knocks, most which put me on my arse, to listen carefully to what people say, but to judge them by their actions, set against what I understand to be their culture, values, strategic intent, and national interests. And I struggle in that space because I'm a white Brit and it's difficult, but trying to get some of that. Iran is very difficult to call. In many ways, it is the unfinished empire made up of four separate parts, the people, the politics, the religious authority, and the IRGC, all subtly different. And while they may not have won too many wars, I cannot, in truth, recall them ever losing a negotiation. So what is my take on the nuclear deal? Well, every great magic trick consists of three parts: the pledge, the turn, and the prestige. So the Iranian pledge presents something quite ordinary. Our revolution is not a threat to you or the region. We Iranians are just like you, in fact, more like you than the GCC countries. They are the cause of unrest. We are the honest brokers. You misunderstand us. Treat us like you. Trust us, and all will be well. But you don't quite believe the siren's message. It needs something more, and that will be the turn. You take the ordinary, and you make it do something extraordinary. So, we Iran, who have tried so hard and spent so much blood and treasure, will decommission our nuclear capability, which for years you have been obsessed by. You're now looking for the secret, the flaw, but you won't find it, because there isn't one. In fact, it seems almost too good to be true, to be believed. It captures your attention and complete focus. And then the prestige. You bring back the revolution recharged, and you do that. To do that, it needs oxygen in the form of hard currency, exports and trade. It needs to be an insider in the international tent. Syria costs some 6 to 9 billion a year, while Hezbollah 150 million. Iran doesn't need a nuclear weapon right now, but sure as hell I sense it needed money and access to the international markets, and for others such as General Soleimani, that was an acceptable short-term deal. Many of Iran's more aggressive interests and opportunities in the region come from instability and uncertainty, and as someone once said, you have to learn the rules of the game and then you have to play it better than anyone else. And for the moment, General Soleimani does. Briefly, to Saudi Arabia. Today, the kingdom might find the old maxim that the enemy of my enemy is my friend no longer applies. Daesh are an uncomfortable Sunni cuckoo in there and the rest of the GC nation's nest. So today's line might just be the enemy of my enemy, and that would be Iran is my enemy, and that would be Daesh. So Saudi and the rest of the GCC are for the moment caught, just as Herr Hitler was, in having to fight on multiple fronts. Yemen, Bahrain, Syria, Iraq, and many more. And it didn't work out well for Germany. But my general concern is I look at the outpouring of emotion, passion, revenge, retribution and retaliation of religion, refugees and sectarian fuel, fueled by all either or for or against, and that will make predictions difficult to calculate. We will seek to take a measured, considered and appropriate view, but the decision will inevitably be late. Others will seize the fire, adapting, taking fleeting opportunities and discarding them at will, and so much faster than we in the West can, while we continue to grapple with understanding what is actually happening. We are politically not well equipped to fight in the conflict that demands we stand on all fronts facing in one direction and welcome into our ranks those two strongest warriors, patience and time. We are, I sense, like a frog being slowly boiled. The military can, in extremists, contain a situation we cannot solve it. We never have. It takes other skills of government and the international community, social, political, economic, legal, diplomatic, intelligence, understanding, cultural awareness to wrestle with giants in order to play the same game better than anyone else. So what do I see as a soldier? The western aspect of Syria will be consolidated by the Russians and the Iranians to ensure the major supply route and the cities are held by the weakened Assad regime. The eastern aspect, the so-called Daesh Caliphate, will be contained through the use of air, Russian regime and coalition air forces, but will continue to hold significant territory in Iraq and Syria. Iran will be strengthened, will strengthen its political and military influence in both of these countries, Iraq and Syria. Daesh will continue to act as a beacon for radical violent extremists within the region and to the increasing virtual caliphate that sits amongst all our communities. And Daesh will provide the reason for the IRGC to maintain not insignificant military forces in both theatres for their own ends. Russia will not wish to extend its military footprint significantly, but will look to consolidate economic opportunities, weapon sales, oil dividends and trade where it can, but be willing to re-engage if its gains are threatened. The West will continue to prevaricate, selecting specific issues to drill down on, but lacking an overall and collective will to ensure regional stability. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We've had three very distinct views, and I think we've got a lot to talk about. I'm now going to ask for comments or questions. Can I ask, can you introduce yourself, and can you face sideways so that not only can we hear you on the panel, but those at the back of the room, and also, and you signal that we actually, in fact, have got a microphone, so if you wait until you get the microphone, you don't have to face backwards. First of all, yes, please. The microphone's on its way.
Thank you. I'm Lord Wright, non-executive figure of power. Crossbench member of the House of Lords. Can I ask the panel two questions? One, if I'm not misquoting him, I think Derek Conley said that we should continue to strengthen the opposition in Syria. Now, can I tell the panel that Mary Dzhevsky in today's Guardian says the following? You will also hear highly placed United States officials increasingly admitting that the administration's insistence on removing Assad was a huge mistake. Have any of the panel got a comment to make on that? And my second question, please, if I'm allowed a second, is on Oman. Jack Straw mentioned Oman's relations with Iran. How do you explain, or do you believe, the claim that Oman is part of Mohammed bin Salman's military alliance?
This is going carefully to what Graham said about likely outcomes in Syria. And I think it's all too possible, at least probable, that unless the opposition, excluding Nusra and those who are considered unacceptable, are sustained through negotiation, if there is one, and that actually requires heft in support of them, that we will end up exactly like that, with a choice for the people of Syria of Assad, supported by Qasem Soleimani, or ISIS. And that will be the biggest recruiting sergeant that ISIS can have, frankly. And ISIS is exactly as Graham also said, a global operation, and it strikes at us. And therefore, I think we have been neglectful over the past 2-3 years in not finding ways to provide more effective support. I think it's still a priority. It doesn't mean to say that I'm in favor of the continuation of the war. I just don't think we'll get peace. The
Okay. Lord Wright's first question, I personally think, and thought for a long time, it was a mistake to make the removal of Assad a precondition of negotiations. And that has now been accepted as being an error, just as it was an error to exclude Iran from the Geneva talks. It was absurd, because you have to deal with who you've got to deal with. I mean, the Russians, I think, have now accepted that Assad needs to go as a condition subsequent of any concluding settlement, because he would be a pernicious and disruptive part of a settlement. But on your first question, the answer, I agree with Mary Jajewski, who I think is here, by the way, so she'll be pleased to hear that you read her piece. On Oman, well, you may have other information from me, but I have to say that I was in Iran twice last year, and I got no sense whatever that they saw themselves as a subsidiary of Saudi Arabia or part of the military alliance. Indeed, they were very heavily critical of Saudi Arabia's actions in the Yemen. Incredibly critical of this. After all, the Yemen, they share a border with the Yemen, and critical, therefore, of the UAE's involvement there. And the Iranians certainly trust them, because the Iranians used Oman to represent them here in the UK when diplomatic relations between us and Iran were breached following the invasion of our embassy in November 2011.
Just quick, so I think Oman is just about to head into uncertain times. Sultan Qaboos is not a well man, wonderful fellow that he is, but he's not well. And I sense the internal debate that will then follow will have them looking inward rather than actually seeing themselves playing a wider role in the space that's available. They could have done that and would have done it brilliantly in the past. I sense that the timing is just crap. And so life is like that. On the Assad, unfortunately, so often I find the debate turns around into a black and white, good and bad, and actually, in fact, Assad was always in the grey space. We're going to end up in a situation where, even with consolidation, his forces, the numbers, are just insufficient to control Syria. So he'll only be able to control a part. It's just a statement of maths. And so what is in the other part? Well, then I sense that that is what we should be concerned of. And it will require us, with close dialogue with Russia, it will require us to understand, in fact, that we'll be parts in many ways. I sense our relationship with Russia is probably more important because they're pragmatic and practical for all their faults. Iran will play a longer and distant game.
So. Just to come back on Iran, I didn't ask, it wasn't really addressed, but I mean, the question was also about, I think, the Saudi coalition alliance. But just to say that Oman obviously has been playing a very constructive role, I think, in trying to host bring people together on Yemen specifically. And it's not there are clear roles for neighbouring states in the Arabian Peninsula to try to engineer a satisfactory solution to that. And they've supported the UN troops.
Frank Dobney, I'm an engineer with an interest in rebuilding the Middle East, and I fully expect within the next year to be teaching reconstruction skills in Lebanon, Jordan, and inshallah in Damascus and Aleppo within the next year. I'm troubled because I'm seeing something that scares the hell out of me appearing on social media over the last week. Three times I've seen mentions of Saudi Arabian possession of nuclear weapons. The final one occurred last night with somebody on Fox TV. He claimed to be an ex-CIA person, and he was saying that they are in possession of between 4 and 7 warheads. We're letting the same genie out of the bottle that we saw in 2003. because you can't prove a negative. What would we recommend? The opinion on social media is that they bought them from the Pakistanis. My good friend, the Pakistani defence attaché, is sitting beside me. How would you suggest we proceed before this gets out of hand?
Well, I haven't seen the reports. I'm not convinced that Saudi Arabia made it clear through various voices that were Iran to go down this path, to be proven to have done so way down the road, then they would aspire, probably they would aspire to a weapon. But this would be something that would require some sort of response that's out there. But I don't think there's any solid information to underpin it, actually. But I don't know if Graham has been following.
I haven't, but the interesting one with nuclear weapons in the Middle East is, in many ways, is trying to understand the leverage. I think the leverage sits with not owning the weapon, maybe having the possibility of either creating one or buying one gives you significantly more leverage. If you, in fact, went so far as to be sure to have one, it probably would be not at all in your favour or best interest. So I sense that if I met everybody that claimed to be in the SAS or the CIA, you know, the other day, you'd fill London and beyond with. So I wouldn't put much of that. But there will be discussions, and it will continue, because others will look towards, you might say, in preparation for what would we need to do, whether it's ballistic defense, whether it's bunkering, whether it's separation of power, whether it be moving back, what are called computer-based data bank, all of that, you know, will be part of just an understandable change in profile across the region.
I'm just going to make one point, and that is some time ago there was a conference in the region discussing how we could get a non-proliferation conference together about the region. There is one difficulty. There is one country that does have nuclear weapons. It's not signed up to the nuclear, the non-proliferation treaty, and won't come to that sort of conference, which makes, in a sense, a very, very big vacuum. I get a call, gentlemen, here.
Yes, Hajir Nemoyan, a former writer on this, these matters. Mr. Straw, Lord Straw, was saying earlier about Iran's elections. First of all, do you know, Lord Straw, that Ayatollah Rafsanjani is being denounced as being one of your agents in Iran in the present day? I'm not going to ask you on that, so it's okay. But we were earlier talking about Syria, and President Erdogan of Turkey is a major player. He is, to put it mildly, an enigma to all of us at the moment. He seems to be looking both ways. Whereas the Americans are giving military aid to the Kurds of Syria, he's bombing them and helping ISIS. But at the weekend, I read an analysis by an American sociologist who believed that the way Turkey is going is very similar to Mussolini's Italy before the war. Do you have any opinions on that subject?
Thank you very much for your enablement of me, but it hasn't happened. I appreciate the compliment. I hadn't spotted that they're saying that Rafsanjani was one of my agents, but the Iranian media, particularly conservative media, is full of conspiracy theories. And although I regard myself as a friend of Iran, indeed I'm a friend of Iran, that kind of makes me the subject of more conspiracies. Anyway, for the avoidance of doubt, in case anybody is here from one of those conservative Iranian media outlets, former President Rafsanjani is not one of my agents. Indeed, I don't have any. Derek alluded to this, so did Graham. I mean, Iran is under a really complicated power structure. It is not a classic dictatorship. It is not, by no means, a classic democracy. And you have different centres of power. And when there is a democratic space. Its size varies according to circumstances. There is a great tussle, fight going on for the future of Iran, partly played out through the agency of these elections and partly in other ways. Syria and Turkey, I mean, the Turks have resolutely denied that they've helped ISIS. And that's, they certainly supported the rebels, and that was their position is no different from the West in the early part of the conflict in Syria. I personally, I'm going to put a fair amount about Turkey. I don't believe it's going to go the way of Mussolini. I think that the strength of its institutions is very much greater than Mussolini's Italy. There is still a vibrant opposition there. And whether President Erdogan is to people's taste or not, I mean, the truth is, in elections which were, on the whole, fair and clean, he did win a majority. You can't get away from that. And he is popular. And if you compare the circumstances of Turkey before the AK Party took over, and Abdullah Gül and Erdogan took over, the circumstances for the vast majority of people in Turkey have dramatically improved. And that's why he is popular. The other thing just to say, I mean, to say for the Turkish government is that it was a bit, so if you like, Nixon China, but it took somebody of Erdogan's position and stature to be the first leader in Turkey to seek a negotiated settlement with the Kurds. And as you know, he was negotiating with Öcalan in jail. And that was proceeding very well. It's one of the many, many collateral tragedies of the Syrian conflict that has ended and it's been replaced by this bloody further round of warfare in Turkey with the Kurds.
And one
more question,
please.
Yeah. John Roberts with Methinks Limited. Slightly concerned at the fact that on the one side we now see an increasing de facto alliance between Syrian government, Assad, Russia, Iran, and the Kurds of Syria. And on the other side you see Turkey talking to Saudi Arabia about whether or not there should be some kind of collective ground response to this. Now, given the strained relations, to say the least, between Russia and Turkey, are we actually looking at the prospects of some kind of a hot war involving a NATO country?
Personal view, would be that I don't believe that it's about to break out anytime soon. I think that the Russian, the Turkey, and the Kurds are all reasonably pragmatic. I don't see Iran looking to, in fact, try to get that level of uncertainty as being beneficial to the gains they've made, and I don't believe it's in Turkey's interest either, nor Saudi. So I could see how you could come up with a perfect storm. I'm just not buying it from what I'm looking at right now, but it's a weak answer to a weak question.
Well, there's clearly a lot of concern, I think, on the part of obviously the Turks, but the opposition, about the control of the route to and from Aleppo and the town of Hatay, to the north of Aleppo. And Turkish concerns specifically about the possibility that the Kurdish YPG and all the regime, others will take it at the expense of the opposition. So that concern is there, talk is there. I think it's unlikely. I think some of the talk is designed to put pressure on the United States and others to make them prioritize this, because it would be serious, and the the crisis that will occur in and around Aleppo if it is besieged for a long period. Let's hope the cessation of hostilities works, but it's a hope, it's no more than that. Will be horrible, and the flow of refugees, if they manage to get out of the area anyway, will also be incrementally awful, adding to what we've already got. But I guess it is more yet another of those screams of pain from countries, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, which see how this crisis has gone, and people have basically been hands off through most of it. But I agree, the Turkish sort of approach to the Kurds in particular, and the Kurdish opposition in the north, and the resumption of the struggle with the PKK is one of the appalling pieces of fallout to get into it.
Thank you. Hooking Walker, former diplomat. I'd like to ask a question of the panel arising out of the title of the panel, which includes the word sectarian. I think the panel entirely, well, anyway, very, very largely, presented the Iranian-Saudi relationship in terms of power politics, which is probably right. However, the Sunni world had been very worried by the so-called Shia crescent for a long time. I think it was the previous king of Jordan, was it, or was it the present one, who talked about the Shia crescent and the worries of it. And so I just propose the question, don't the panel think that maybe in their initial presentations they slightly underestimated the role of sectarianism in what's going on?
Well, I don't think I did, because I was seeking to bring out that there is a confessional, I didn't use the adjective sectarian, but it's a confessional divide, and that's why I said that, I mean, certainly from the time in the 16th century when the Safavids proclaimed Shiism as the national faith of the Persians, that sectarian divide has been very strong. And it, one of the complexities about Iran is that it's got this definition as a Shia community, but it also got this very powerful definition as a Persian nation. And sometimes the two are parallel, sometimes they're not, but in both they see as exceptional. And so their exceptionalism as Persians, living within well-defined borders and a very, very deep history and culture, then is reinforced by this their Shiism. And really one of the reasons I mentioned being in Iran for 2 weeks during Ashura is that, I mean, this is a period of mourning, of a kind of, I mean, we used to have it with Guy Fawkes, you know, when we the Protestants commemorated the attempt by Catholics to blow up Parliament, but I mean, it's gone now. But this is 2 months of mourning for the fact that their martyr, their first martyr Hussein, was assassinated in Kabul by the Sunni. So it's there, it's just a fact of life. And how strongly this influences their politics varies over time. But I mean, I think, you know, the Shia are worried about the Sunni domination of the Muslim world. And it's something that each side's either going to fight about this or, with some prayer, learn to live with it.
Thank you. I'm not going to call any more in this session. There'll be a chance in the next session. We must move on to the next session. But can I ask you to thank this panel?